Chapter 15 The Voice. My captors and I were sitting in the tarped area outside the tent. It was the third day since I had been taken. The sun was starting to drop toward the horizon. Soon it would be cool. Farzi was standing near the containers with the food. In a few minutes it would be time to eat. Food was the last thing I wanted. My stomach was always tied in knots. The trees provided shade, but it was June, and the sun was burning through the leaves. There was no breeze, we had little water, and I was thirsty. Mitchell was reading from the book of Emmanuel, the fascinating tome that he had written. I was learning more about his church, the church of the firstborn in the last days, and how he was the prophet of the world. Then he started reading scripture. When he talked of God, it was the creepiest thing you could imagine. The words of God coming from the face of the devil. It was the scariest thing I had ever seen. I shifted on the bucket. It was early afternoon and the day was very calm. I was dressed in my robe. It was already filthy and only getting worse. Though it had only been 3 days, it already seemed like years. I looked up at the sky as the sound of an airplane filtered through the trees. It seemed there were a lot of them now. I could hear them almost constantly. I searched for the aircraft through a break in the leaves, but it was too high to be seen. Way too high to see me. A couple of times that morning some helicopters had flown over the ridge, but none of them had been very close. At least, I didn't think they were, although it was hard to tell for certain as the sound of their rotors reverberated up and down the canyon walls. Although it was terribly disappointing that none of them came close enough to see me, at least I knew that they were out there looking. I pulled against the steel cable that held me. If I could just get free, if I could run into an opening, if I could signal them in some way. The sun was high now, almost at its apex in the sky. Hot, dry, I felt like I was going to die of thirst. We were getting very low on water. A few cups was all that remained in the plastic containers. I was sitting in my usual place on the bucket by my tiny sapling when I heard it. Far away, so far away. My heart instantly jumped into my throat. Mitchell heard it too. He fell silent. His eyes grew wild in fear and anger, his face growing hard as stone. Farzi was sitting right beside him. She didn't seem to hear. Mitchell reached out and grabbed her shoulder, commanding her to hold very still. Elizabeth, the sound drifted through the trees. Elizabeth. The voice was faint as a breeze, soft as a whisper in the night. I strained my ears to hear it, praying it would come again. Nothing. I held my breath. Nothing. Mitchell slowly stood. I continued straining. Elizabeth. It was drifting through the trees from the bottom of the canyon. It was so faint, so far away. I wondered if I had imagined it. But I know that it was real, and Mitchell knew it too. I thought I'd recognized my uncle's voice. I wanted to scream. I wanted to cry. I wanted to jump up and down and wave my arms. I wanted to yell and shriek. Mitchell moved toward me like an animal on the attack. He knelt down right beside me, his face just a few inches from my own. I have a knife. His breath was hot and foul. One tiny peep, and you know what I will do. I stared at him in terror. Yes, I knew. If you make a sound, I'll tape your mouth shut. I glanced in fear toward the bottom of the canyon, tears of frustration burning my eyes. Elizabeth! The sound drifted through the trees again. If he comes into our camp, if he even gets close, I'm going to kill him, Mitchell sneered. Do you understand that? If you call him and he hears you, if he comes up here, I'm going to stick him with my knife. He's alone. He won't be ready. If you call out and he finds us, I will kill him right here and now. So you better pray he doesn't find you unless you want him dead.
I turned in terror toward the sound of the voice. I couldn't hear it any longer. I listened, tilting my head to the side. Yes. Yes, there it was again. Was it really my Uncle David? I couldn't tell for sure. I peered through the trees. The mountain oaks were thick with leaves. I found a gap in the branches and looked down the side of the canyon.
It was much too steep and thick with trees to see more than a few yards. I could look across the canyon at the mountain on the other side, but I could not see anything when I looked down. None of us had set so much as a foot outside of the camp, and I had no idea what was down there. I didn't know how far down it was to the bottom. I didn't know if there was a trail, a road, a stream. Mitchell was as taut as a wire. He didn't move. He hardly breathed. He stood there listening, tense and ready to spring. I didn't know where he kept his knife, but I knew that it was always close. It seemed that he could make it appear out of nowhere. I pictured it again in my mind, long, black, serrated on one side, a cutting knife, a deadly knife. And if I had learned anything about Brian David Mitchell, it was that he was evil enough to kill. So we waited there together, listening for the sound of someone calling out my name. I was being torn apart inside. My heart beat with both terrible excitement and utter fear. Someone was looking for me. Someone was very near, calling my name. I might be rescued. He might find me. But if he did, would Mitchell kill him? If I screamed, the man might hear me. He might try to climb up the side of the mountain. But would he find me? I could picture Mitchell, this crazy man, jumping out from behind a tree and slitting his throat. My uncle would be dead. I would still be captured. Nothing would really change. Then would Mitchell kill me too? Would he move me somewhere else? Somewhere worse? Somewhere more dangerous? Someplace much farther away from my family and my home? I remembered how hard it had been to climb the mountain. There had been times when we had been forced to crawl on our hands and knees. It might take, what, an hour for my uncle, if it was my uncle, to climb up the mountain to the camp? Plenty of time for Mitchell to kill me. Plenty of time to get ready to attack whoever came into camp. For a moment, a fantasy flashed into my mind, the dream of a desperate little girl. I imagined lots of men, maybe 20, maybe more. They knew where the camp was without me screaming. They surrounded the camp. There was nothing Mitchell could do. He couldn't hurt me. He couldn't attack them all. He might turn to me in anger, but he would know that it hadn't been my fault, that they had found me. I'd not even made a sound. He couldn't be mad at me. He couldn't blame me. I had done everything he had told me to do. But the men had found me anyway. I wanted it so badly that I could hardly breathe. I wanted to be away from there. I wanted to be away from him. I wanted to go home. I wanted to see my family. I wanted to be safe and not hurt anymore. But I knew it wasn't real. There was no group of men. They weren't going to surround us. There was only one man, and Mitchell was going to kill him if he came into the camp. I glanced at Barzee. Her face was mean and hard. Mitchell moved closer to me. His eyes were as deadly as the steel of his knife. "You will die here," his eyes seemed to say. "You and whoever is down there in the canyon. There's no way this ends well if he starts climbing towards our camp." My heart fell into my stomach. I wasn't just broken-hearted. I was shattered. Simply shattered. I had lost my only chance. I started shaking. My knees turned to rubber. My throat grew so tight I couldn't breathe. The bitter disappointment seemed to crush my soul. We waited, all of us listening intently. The voice called again a time or two, but then faded. A long time passed. We didn't move. The voice was never heard again. That night, I cried myself to sleep again. And though I didn't know it, 4 or 5 miles to the west, my mother cried herself to sleep as well. Chapter 16. Wind and Noise. Early the next afternoon, I was sitting on my appointed seat. The bucket had become the only object to which I could lay claim within the camp, when I heard a faint noise and vibration. I immediately looked up. It grew closer, louder. The thump of helicopter blades echoed down the canyon. They slapped the air like gunshots, coming at me before the sound of the engines could reach my ears. Without even thinking, I stood up and moved toward the sound. my head up, my eyes searching, the blue sky obscured by all the trees. Mitchell froze. He was only a few feet away from me. Barzee was on the other side of him, her face turned toward the sky. The sound was getting closer. Her eyes were growing very wide. The helicopter seemed to be moving down the slope of the mountain, and it was moving very slow. It grew louder. So low. So slow. This helicopter was obviously searching, and it was moving directly toward the camp. We had heard the sound of airplanes before, but they had always been far away and so high that they could never have found me. And we'd heard a few helicopters, but they were just the sound of beating rotors and noisy engines in the sky. Most times, I never even saw them, only heard them as they moved across the top of the ridges on the mountain. But this one was different. It sounded like it was moving directly toward us. The sound grew louder. The roar of engines, the sound of rushing air. I started to feel it now. The trees began to move, blowing toward the bottom of the canyon. The helicopter was coming right toward us, and it was so close. Instinctively, I pulled against the cable around my leg. My eyes darted here and there, searching for an opening, any break in the trees where I could be seen. I moved toward a spot of sunlight, breaking through the branches, my eyes always toward the skies. Mitchell was frozen in uncertainty and fear. Barzee seemed to be made of stone. I expected Mitchell to spring into action, but he seemed incapable of doing anything. For the first time, a thought crossed my mind. Maybe he doesn't have all the answers. Maybe he doesn't even have a plan. I lifted my hands toward the skies. I almost started screaming, "I'm here! I'm here!" They were going to find me. My nightmare was nearly over. It's impossible to describe how powerful the helicopter seemed to be. The noise filled my ears. Jet turbines. The power of the rotors. I couldn't see the helicopter yet, but the trees were bending down around me. Frantically, I searched above me, reaching out toward the wind. Suddenly, I felt a vice grip on my arm. Mitchell pulled, his hand like cold steel on my skin as he forced me toward the tent. Barzee was already there, tugging frantically at the zipper. We piled in, almost tumbling onto the floor. I made a move toward the opening, but Mitchell was already standing in my way. I slid toward the corner of the tent and waited. They might not see me, but they would see the tent. There were blue and gray tarps all over the ground. They had to see our camp. They had to be looking for me. Why else would this helicopter be hovering down the side of a mountain? They would send someone up to investigate. Surely, I would be found. It seemed the helicopter was right above us. The branches on the trees were being beaten down. I looked up through the air vent in the top of the tent, but I could only see a tiny slit of sky. But I could see the branches blowing all around us. Dust and dry leaves were in the air. Seconds passed, and then a minute. Surely, they will see us. Truthfully, I wasn't certain that all this effort was part of the search for me. It seemed a little bit extravagant. But why else would a helicopter be hovering right over our camp? The chopper didn't move. They must have seen the tent, the camp, all of our utensils scattered here and there. I looked anxiously toward my captors. Fear showed on their faces. I wanted to scream with joy. I imagined that maybe the pilots on the helicopter had heat-seeking equipment that would allow them to see through the fabric of the tent. Mitchell's face was taut, his eyes wide, his lips tightly drawn against his teeth. Barzee was huddled in the tent beside me. They know it's over, I told myself. They're going to catch them. They will be in prison, and I will be free. More seconds passed. The helicopter remained directly above us, the wind blowing the tent like a flag in the wind. Mitchell was peering through the vent in the roof, the same as me. His expression looked like a bomb was about to fall on his head. I wanted to cry with relief. I wanted to scream in pure joy. Then the helicopter started moving away. I followed the sound with my eyes. The helicopter didn't dart away, but moved slowly, inching down the canyon as if it were still searching for something. The wind began to decrease, the branches blown with much less force. The dirt began to settle. We all waited. Another minute, the sound faded. A couple of minutes, the helicopter was gone. I stared in disbelief. Had they not seen the tents, the tarps, the dugout and our camping gear? Had they not seen anything? I wanted to cry out in frustration. They had hovered directly over us. I expected them to, I don't know, drop a sheriff from a cable, yell out over some loudspeakers, circle around and fly back over the camp. Anything to give me a signal that help was on the way. But nothing. They did nothing. The sound of the helicopter was completely gone now, leaving only the quiet of the mountain and the gentle summer breeze. I thought that maybe they would return. I thought maybe someone would come hiking up the mountain. Police? Someone prepared to save me? But no one did. The afternoon dragged by. All the time I waited, alert, my ears straining to pick up the sound of someone hiking up the canyon, calling out my name. All afternoon I waited. All night. All the next day. I tried to keep my hopes up, but I realized that no one was going to come. Another heartbreaking moment. Another bone-crushing defeat. We spoke little of the disappearance of the helicopter, but I could see that Mitchell took it as another sign from God. If it is God's will that I do this, let the helicopter fly away. I don't know that he ever said those words, but it was just too easy for him to interpret it as another sign from heaven. However, after the helicopter, he also became more cautious. He realized that they were still searching for me, making a real effort to locate me, and he was going to have to be more careful. So while he took it as another sign, I took it as nothing but another opportunity lost, and I struggled to explain it to myself. It was so frustrating trying to understand how the helicopter could have missed seeing us. Maybe they thought it was a homeless camp. But we were so far up on the mountain, that wouldn't have made any sense. Maybe they thought we were some hikers. But if we were and they were looking for me, wouldn't they have wanted to talk to us to see if we had seen anything? I thought back on the other opportunities lost, tiptoeing down the steps in my house, just a few feet from my parents' bedroom, crouching behind the bushes as the police car had driven by. The first morning, after he had raped me and then left me alone inside the tent, that was before I had been cabled, the voice calling me from down the canyon, the helicopter hovering right over my head. Chapter 17. Tracks in the Mud. Water was a big deal. It was precious. It was rare. Mitchell and Barzee rationed it closely. It took a lot of work to get, and we conserved it carefully. We kept a small bowl to wash our hands in, but that was all the washing we ever did. The rest of the water we drank. It was warm and tasted of plastic, but I didn't care. Getting my share of water was a really big deal. Mitchell hated going down to the spring at the bottom of the canyon, which meant that every couple of days we'd run out of water. He'd usually make us go a day or so before he'd finally gather up the plastic containers and head on down the canyon. These waterless days were miserable. I was already hot and dry and filthy. Going a day without any water while enduring the summer heat only made it worse. When he'd go for water, I'd beg him to let me go with him. His reply was always the same, "You're not ready," which was an interesting thing to say. Already he was starting to manipulate me. "Be good, and I will reward you. I can be generous and kind, but you have to earn it, and you will owe me once I have given some freedoms to you." It's ironic that by letting me off the cable, he was trying to reel me in. Even then, he was trying to get me to love him, but it certainly didn't work. Never did I develop any feelings for him or Barzee. All I ever felt was fear and repulsion. When it came to the possibility of letting me go down with him to get some water, I don't think he was worried that I would escape. For one thing, he could always hold on to the other end of my cable, and it was two adults against a child. Hardly an even fight. But trying to get away wasn't what motivated me. I was simply desperate to relieve the boredom. I was so tired of being cabled that I wanted to scream. Watching as he headed down the mountain, I longed to be free of the cable that held me in its narrow cage. Looking back on it now, I think that might have been the beginning of my subjection to him. Soon, I would be walking around the city with Mitchell and Barzee and not telling anyone who I was. Soon, I would be questioned by a policeman in the Salt Lake City Library and not dare to answer when he asked me my name. People wonder how I could have done that. Why didn't I cry out for help? Why didn't I scream to escape when, finally, I had the opportunity? The answer is difficult to explain, but it comes down to fear. Fear for my life, fear for my family, fear of the pain and humiliation. Part of it, too, was the constant intimidation. Part of it was the feeling that I had already lost my life and everything worth having, the feeling that I had gone too far to be saved. All of these emotions were going to overwhelm me. They were going to make it possible for Mitchell to take me into the city and lead me around like a dog. Every ounce of energy and courage I had was used on maintaining my drive to survive. Nothing was left to use on plans of escape, yet. And I think most of that started when I was raped and chained up every day. One morning, Mitchell and Barzee had a big fight. They were constantly at each other's throats, always nagging and poking and getting on each other's nerves. But this one was a big one. Lots of screaming and yelling and calling bad names. Barzee was tired of all the attention I had been getting. "You're just being lustful," she screamed at her husband. "Just because she's young and beautiful, you're being lustful. You're being carnal. It's not right." I sat on my bucket and listened to them fight about me, wishing I could be somewhere else. They screamed at each other for a while, but eventually settled down. After they had a chance to cool off, Mitchell approached his wife, all humble and submissive. He never said that he was sorry, but he was certainly groveling and acting like a child. Then I saw something I had never seen before, but would see again. In an act of contrition, Mitchell asked if she wanted him to give her a blessing, kind of a special prayer that is anointed on her head. Her body language seemed to soften, and she nodded yes. Mitchell put his hands on her head and started to pray. Using his authority as a prophet, he reminded her that he was God's servant. He had been called by God, but just like Moses needed Aaron, he needed her as well. She was his strength and wisdom. She was smarter and more worthy than he. While he was forced to go into the world, she was to be his rock and salvation, his source of spiritual strength. He told her that she was the one who made it possible for him to lead the world out of sin and oppression. He needed her. God needed her. She was the great one, not he. He told her that she was a friend and companion to Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Mary Magdalene. She was a friend to all the great women in the history of the world. Her position in heaven was assured. Finally, he reminded her that she needed to be patient when he was weak. He would try to be better, but she would always be greater than he. She needed to show that by her patience when he did wrong. When the blessing was over, I stared at them, dumbfounded. Barzee was beaming. She was eating it up. I thought it was the strangest thing I'd ever heard. And I had heard a lot of strange things over the past few weeks. Sometime during that second week, I begged him once again to let me go with him to get some water. It seemed that he and Barzee had already talked about it and made a decision. Without saying anything, he walked to where my cable was padlocked to the longer cable, anchored between the trees. He pulled out the key that he kept on a string around his neck and unlocked my cable. Holding tightly, he gave it a brutal tug to remind me that I was still under his control. I didn't care. I was overjoyed at the prospect of getting out of the camp, and I hadn't entirely given up on the idea of trying to get away. I knew there might be an opportunity to run. I had another secret plan. I used to read Louis L'Amour westerns all the time. It seemed the old trackers could track a rattlesnake across a rock.
I suspected there would be mud around the spring, and I intended to leave as many footprints as I could. If I could leave some trace behind, the searchers might track me back to the camp. At least, that was my hope. It wasn't a lot, I know that. But when you don't have a lot to cling to, you hang on tight to what you have. We started down the side of the mountain. There was no trail, and we had to cut our way back and forth between the scrub oaks and pines. It was steep and difficult to travel. The weeds were high. Thistle, dyer's weed, June grass, an occasional patch of dying sunflowers. Mitchell held the cable and walked in front of me. Barzi, always just a few steps behind. Whenever we were about to break out of the cover of the trees and move into the open, Mitchell would stop and take a look around, listening and looking, his head cocked to the wind. Standing on the edge of the trees, he always pulled the cable short, forcing me to stand beside him. We'd stand there until he was satisfied. Then he'd continue to lead me down the mountain. Halfway down, he turned to cut across the mountain at an angle instead of heading straight down. A small meadow spread before us, and for the first time, I had a chance to really look around. I realized that we were in one of the canyons that cut east of my house. Looking west, way down to where the sides of the canyon came together, I could see a small portion of the Salt Lake Valley. I was startled for a moment. We weren't that far from my home. Looking down on the valley, I could see the dark outlines of tall buildings, roads, and freeways. Though all of the details were lost in the distance, the city didn't seem that far away. I looked up at the blue sky. Not a hint of clouds or rain. The sides of the mountains were mostly dry now, though there were occasional patches of weeds that dotted the canyon with spots of green. The south face of the canyon, the one opposite me, was scattered with trees and outcroppings of rock. Looking at the rocky slope that lay below us, I realized a couple of things. First, it was going to be very hard to climb back up the mountain, for it was steep and hard going. Second, Mitchell had been very smart in where he had placed his camp, because it was halfway up the side of the canyon. There was no easy way to get to it from either the top or the canyon floor, and it was high enough up in the mountains that no one was going to stumble upon it unless they knew exactly where it was. Turning, I looked back toward our camp, but it was completely hidden among the trees. In fact, I saw no trace of human passing. For Mitchell had been careful not to ever walk the same path so as not to make a trail. I only had a minute to look around before Mitchell tugged on my cable to get me moving again. We continued down the mountain. The ground turned bare. It started to get very rocky as the terrain became steeper and more exposed. We continued at an angle, the slope far too steep to hike straight down. After a while, we had to use our hands to keep from sliding. It was treacherous, and we were going very slowly. Eventually, it got so steep that Mitchell had to let go of my cable. He wasn't worried. It was obvious I could not escape, and he needed both hands to keep from sliding. Afraid that I would trip on my cable, I coiled it up and held it in my left hand, using my right to keep me from falling as we slowly worked our way down. Over the coming weeks, I would learn that they called this part of the trail the Crucible. And that's exactly what it was, a severe test created by a miserable and exhausting trail. The Crucible was steep and dangerous. It was on the side of the mountain that faced south, directly into the summer sun. No trees to provide any shade, steep and rocky. It was difficult for any man to hike along the Crucible, let alone a 14-year-old girl. Let alone a girl who was dragging a steel cable and carrying a 30-pound container of sloshing water. I grew to hate the Crucible, and I hiked it many times. Eventually, we scratched and clung our way down to the bottom of the canyon. Here, there was a small spring that seeped out of the canyon floor. For a moment, Mitchell seemed to take a look around, listening for the sound of any voices. He stared up and down the stream as he listened, then looked around the soft earth for any signs of any footprints. Barzi waited patiently while he did a security review. It was cool in the shade, and the stream was tucked inside a pretty glade.
It flowed gently downhill, gathering a little more water out of the aquifer as it descended, but it was never more than a trickle meandering across the soft ground. Along the stream, the trees were green and full, lots of hardwoods, pines, and oaks. The grass along the stream was thick, with peppermint and watercress mingled in. "We're going to bathe," Mitchell told me. I had mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, I was so filthy that the thought of getting clean was more appealing than I could imagine. On the other, the thought of getting undressed in front of him sent a sickening shiver down my spine. Mitchell lifted up one of the rubber containers we had carried with us and nodded at me. "Take your clothes off," he commanded. I froze, the words cutting me to the core. I flashed back to the first morning in the tent when Barzee had commanded me to take my pajamas off. When I didn't move, Mitchell took a step toward me, the bucket in his hand. Knowing I couldn't fight him, I pulled the linen robe over my head and dropped it on top of the nearest shrub. Mitchell moved me toward the center of the little stream where the mud was thick and squished between my toes. I stood naked as he dipped the bucket in a pool of standing water and poured it over my head. I nearly went into shock, it was so cold. The water washed over my hair and down my body. He handed me a rough bar of soap and a squirt of all-natural organic shampoo and told me to wash up. He only gave me a couple seconds. Another bucket of ice water, and that was it. My weekly bath was through. Shivering, I moved to a spot in the sun to dry off while he and Barzee washed themselves. When they were finished, we put our dirty robes back on. Then I helped to fill the water containers, working carefully to leave as many footprints in the soft mud as I could. Above the spring on the north side of the mountain, there was a dusty patch, and I tried to leave my footprints there as well, but we only stayed at the stream for a couple of minutes. Mitchell was anxious to get back up to our camp, so we quickly filled our water containers, then headed up the side of the mountain again. It was hot, exhausting work. The summer sun bore down. 100 yards up, I was already dirty and exhausted. I held 2 1-gallon plastic containers of water, and they sloshed heavily in my arms. Up we climbed, my cable dragging behind me. I don't know if Mitchell had decided I wouldn't run off, or if he was only getting sloppy, but after a while, I picked it up and carried it myself. Up we climbed, then we turned to our right. The crucible lay before us. Steep mountain and sharp rocks. I didn't know how I would do it. Climbing, slipping, barely catching my fall. The water felt like a load of heavy sand in my arms. It grew heavier and heavier. We stopped every 5 or 10 minutes to rest. Across the crucible, farther up the mountain as we climbed, I looked ahead of us, not knowing for certain where our camp was. Late that afternoon, we finally stumbled into camp. Before I even had a chance to sit down, Mitchell walked over and locked my cable with the padlock again. I was thinking that, you know, maybe he would leave me uncabled for a while. Maybe he trusted me, at least a little. Maybe he would give me a few minutes without being cabled to the trees. But that wasn't to be the case. At least I can dream, I thought as I listened to the click of the padlock being snapped again. Chapter 18. Food and Wine. A little more than a week into my captivity, we ran out of food. Up to that point, we hadn't eaten well, but we had enough to get by, and I hadn't given a lot of thought as to where our food had come from, or where any more food was going to come from in the future. I just didn't think about it. It was obvious Mitchell and Barzee had been in the camp for a long time. They hadn't starved. They had to continue eating in the future. Surely, they had a plan. But then we ran out of food. The coolers were completely empty. Nothing in the plastic containers, no raisins, no tortillas, no crackers or apples. Nothing at all to eat. In my church, on the first Sunday of the month, we fast for 24 hours. Then we take what money we would have spent on food and give it to the poor. It's a day of fasting and prayer and giving, which is a good thing. But I guess I'm just a baby. It was always really hard for me to go hungry. So even though I was used to going a day without eating, it was very discouraging to be trapped in a camp without any food.
I'm the kind of person who has to eat every 3 hours or I feel miserable and become a little cranky. And I don't think I'm alone. Most of us don't realize, or we forget because we don't have to do it very often, how quickly we feel hungry and how badly we want to eat. We went a morning without eating, and then a day, and then another. I was getting really hungry. All of us were. It was miserable. My belly hurt. Then I started to wonder, what's going to happen? Is he going to go and get us some food? How is he going to get it? How long is it going to take? About mid-morning, Barzia and I were in the tent. She was teaching me how to patch our robes, which was a good wifely duty and one I had to learn. To do this, she had brought out new robes for us to wear while we mended the linen ones. Initially, they had been a whitish light beige color, but now, they were more brown than beige. The new robes were made from gold sheets that we had to pull over our heads, then secure with a clasp and tie with a sash. The material was cheap and flimsy, but the sheets were not well worn, making them the finest clothing in the camp. They were awkward and ugly, though, with sleeves that fell to our sides in huge triangles, giving them the appearance of an African muumuu. All morning we sewed and patched away, getting the linen robes into fine shape. But it was hot and miserable, and I was getting so hungry. It was the only thing that I could think about. Finally, Mitchell poked his head into the tent and announced, "I'm going to go down to Babylon to plunder." At first, I didn't know what he meant. Babylon? Plunder? But then I got really excited. Going down to Babylon. I was smart enough to figure that one out. He was going down into the world. He was going to get us food. But that wasn't the only thing that made me happy. This meant an entire day without him. I wouldn't get raped. I wouldn't get abused. I wouldn't have to listen to him tell me how he was going to kill my family. I wouldn't have to listen to him tell me how grateful I should be that he'd saved me from the world. I didn't know which was more exciting, a day away from him or the possibility of getting food. Watching him get ready to leave, I felt like a little girl on Christmas morning. My mouth began to water at the prospect of finally having something to eat. My heart raced as he put on his boots and picked up his pack. Yes, I wanted to say, go down to Babylon and get me food. But how was he going to get it? What did plunder really mean? I looked at him confused, but Mitchell didn't offer to explain, which was unusual, for he was always searching for something new to talk about. It turned out that it didn't matter. I would learn about plunder soon enough. Then another thought popped into my mind. Maybe he would bring me some news of what was going on with my family. Maybe he would tell me about the search efforts. I could picture him using the news to torment me. Esther, they were so close and yet so far away. Maybe he would bring me news of the world, anything at all to break the boredom. Or better yet, maybe someone would follow him when he came back to our camp. Maybe someone would stumble upon us while he was gone. Maybe someone would catch him while he was down in the city. I knew all of these things were extremely unlikely, but I couldn't keep the thoughts out of my mind. He was going to the city. He was exposing himself to society, other people, maybe even the police. That had to be helpful. I just couldn't figure out how. Then my heart seemed to jump with the terrifying thought. What if he did get caught? What if he didn't come back? He had the key to the lock on my cable. No key, no freedom. I'd be trapped forever. If he got caught and didn't come back, what would Barzi do? She'd take off and leave me. That's what she'd do. She'd run as far and as fast as she could go if that's what it took to protect herself. She'd leave me there, cabled to the trees in the middle of the mountains. I would die, alone, starving and out of water. It was a terrifying thought. As he got ready to go down into the city, he talked excitedly to himself. For someone who was convinced the world was nothing but a den of sinners, he sure seemed to be in a good mood. Then it occurred to me that he was planning on doing a little descending below all things of his own. Maybe even a lot of descending. He was going down to eat and drink and party.
leaving me cabled to the trees. Mitchell was gone all day. It got hot. A little bit of water for lunch was all we had. The sun moved toward the western horizon. I was getting pretty good at estimating the time by watching as it marched across the tops of the trees. The mountain shadows were growing long. The sun faded behind the highest ridgeline, and evening came on. It started to get cooler. I started to wonder how Mitchell was going to get us any food. He didn't have any money, nothing he could trade for. He might be able to steal a pocketful of something, but how could he possibly get enough to feed us all? What if he came back with nothing? Then I started to get angry. He'd been gone a long, long time. What if he was down there eating and came back with nothing for the rest of us to eat? I kept looking down the mountain, expecting him to walk out of the shadows of the trees. I listened carefully for the sound of branches snapping or the crunch of boots upon the leaves. I was getting really hungry. I couldn't wait for his return. Come on, come on, I was praying inside my head. It grew dark. We waited in the darkness. No fire, no flashlights. It grew colder. Finally, Barzi said it was time to go to bed. We climbed into the tent. I tried to sleep, but I couldn't. I was too hungry, and I was worried now that he was not coming back. But Barzi seemed unconcerned. She knew how far it was down into the city. She knew it was a long and tiring hike. But I had also seen the way she kept her eyes toward the canyon, the way she listened too, hoping to hear the sound of his footsteps across the dry leaves. After a while, I fell asleep. Around 11, I felt her shaking me on the shoulder. He was back. We scrambled out of the tent. He pointed his flashlight at the sacks of food as he placed them on the ground, then set the flashlight on a limb so it would shine between us. He seemed very pleased with himself. The great hunter-gatherer had returned. Barzi seemed very pleased as well. Her husband had provided. What more could she ask? Now it was time for the women to stand in gratefulness and awe. Truth was, I would have kissed the ground he walked on if he would have given me something to eat. I mean, talk about the natural animal coming out. Where's the food? Is all I could think about. The grocery sacks were from an expensive boutique food store on the east side of the city. How could he possibly have afforded it? How did you get this? I asked. I ministered and plundered for it. What does that mean? Stupid of me to ask a question. With Mitchell, there were plenty of simple questions, but no such thing as a simple answer. He started to explain, telling me how in the Old Testament the Lord would lead the children of Israel into battle, and then tell them they could take whatever they had conquered as a reward for the fight. If they wanted it, they could take it. But only the Lord could designate when and where they were allowed to take from others. It could never come from man. So when you're fighting for a righteous cause, and when the Lord commands you to take something, that is plunder. It isn't stealing. It is different, because you're doing it for God. And the Lord had commanded him to plunder, and obeying was how we showed faith in him. He was only doing God's will when he stole from the grocery store. Okay. I got it. Plundering was stealing. I really didn't care. All I knew was I was hungry. But I was also curious. What do you do when you are ministering then? He smiled. This was his territory, and he was happy to explain. When I'm on the street, in a store, wherever the Lord may take me, the true disciples of Christ recognize me as their true prophet. When they do, they give me money. That is how God provided for us. I thought back on the first time I had seen him, that long ago November afternoon in downtown Salt Lake City. So he called it ministering when he was panhandling, which was where he got most of the money we needed to buy food. His elaborate explanation didn't change how I felt. He was a panhandler then and was still a beggar now. He then explained why it had taken him so long. The ministering hadn't gone as well as he had hoped it would. Not so many folks apparently recognized him as the prophet he really was. The good news was that the plundering had gone a little better. But after all the ministering and plundering, he had to go down to Pioneer Park, where some of his people liked to hang out so he could rest a while. Which meant he had to drink a little, smoke a little, whatever it took to gather up his strength for the long hike back up the mountain. Turns out he'd spent most of the afternoon drinking, then had to sleep it off before he had the energy to make it back to camp. "Guess what I saw down there?" Mitchell announced with great pride. I really didn't care. All I wanted was the food. "You should see it." He moved so close that I could smell the tang of sweat and the alcohol on his breath. "I saw my sweet Shir Jashub's face plastered all over the city. It's in every store, on every lamppost. Posters of her absolutely everywhere. And blue ribbons. Thousands of blue ribbons. And the whole time I was walking around the city, seeing Shir Jashub's sweet face looking down on me. You want to know what I thought?" He moved even closer in the darkness. "I thought to myself, I got the real McCoy. I get the most beautiful girl in the city, and that kind of makes me proud." I stared at him, dumbfounded, trying to take in what he had said. Posters of me? All over the city? That meant people were still looking. They hadn't given up, and it wasn't just my family. Other people were looking for me, too. "Beautiful posters everywhere," Mitchell seemed to sing, so proud of what he'd done, so proud of what he'd captured, so proud of what he owned. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a folded piece of paper, holding it up to the light. I saw my smiling face, my name, a description, and a hotline number. My heart raced with anticipation. They were still looking for me. They hadn't given up yet. Maybe there was still hope. I tried not to smile as my hopelessness was chased away. Mitchell watched me carefully, his eyes filled with lust and pride. Then he pulled out the food, cheese and crackers, more raisins, carrots, and mayonnaise. There were even a couple sacks of cookies, something that was very appealing to a 14-year-old girl. It seemed like a massive amount of food. I realize now that it couldn't have fed us more than a few days, but at the time, it seemed like more food than we could eat in a year. I waited, my mouth watering, my instincts for survival kicking into high gear. I had to fight myself not to pounce on it, for I had already learned a hard lesson about patience and food. One morning, I had woken up and eaten a crust of bread before they had taken out the plates and blessed it. I had been severely chastised. Big trouble had come my way. So I knew I couldn't eat anything until they said the prayer. But sometimes Mitchell would pray for 45 minutes. No way was I going to make it that long. Mitchell laid out the food, arranging it carefully for us to see. The last thing he pulled out was a bottle of wine. I paid it no attention. I was focused on the food. "Can we eat?" I begged. "Oh, you'll eat," Mitchell answered. "In fact, you can eat whatever you want. But first, we're going to have the sacrament. We haven't had the sacrament for a long time." I glanced at him. A religious ceremony up here? In the mountains? In the middle of the night over a bunch of store-bought food? Okay, whatever. As long as we got to eat. He opened the wine and filled a pewter mug. The liquid reflected deep red, almost black, in the shadows of the flashlight. I smelled it and pulled away. This was the first time I had ever smelled alcohol. I remember the label was a Merlot. He also had a bottle of white Sauvignon Blanc. After pouring the wine, he put the glass before him, took a slice of bread and broke off three small pieces and placed them on a plate. He took out the scriptures and read a section that talked about the sacrament, then said a prayer. After all this preparation, he passed me the bread. I took a piece of crust and ate it. It tasted so good. My mouth watered. I wanted more. He took the cup of wine and drank some, then passed it to Barzee, who took a drink as well. Then he passed the cup to me. "I'm not going to drink it," I said. The light was dim, the night dark, but I could see that Mitchell was smiling. "Not going to drink it. We'll see," his dark eyes seemed to say. "Drink it," he said. "Drink it," Barzee urged impatiently. The last thing she wanted was to fuss about some wine. "I won't do it," I said. "I can't. I won't." "You will," Mitchell answered in deep anger. His voice was hard, violent. Any good mood of the success of his plunder had been instantly wiped away. He reached over and filled the cup completely. You will drink it all, and you will drink it right now. You're not going to eat until you do. You're not going to move. You can't go to bed. You do this, or you do nothing. You can sit here all night. You can sit here all day tomorrow and the next, but you're going to drink it, and you will.
I stared at the cup of wine, feeling sick. He knew what he was doing. He knew how I felt about drinking. Mormons don't drink alcohol. This was a big deal to me. It was important.
He sat there and stared. No food, no water, no sleep, nothing until you drink it. You will do what I say. Do you understand that, Esther? Drink, work, think, sex. You will do everything I say. If I tell you to drink, you're going to drink it. Now, do you understand?
I shivered as he spoke. There were so many reasons that I didn't want to do it. One of them was religious. I believed that my body was a temple, and I didn't want to harm it. Part of it was the fact that I had made a promise to myself that drinking was something that I would never do. I didn't need it. I wouldn't do it. He was asking me to betray everything that I held dear. Finally, I was repulsed by the fact that it was bad for me. That wasn't anything based on religion. That was just a fact. Now, I know that might seem a bit ridiculous, considering the circumstances I was in. I was being raped every day, sometimes multiple times a day, by a dirty old man who had only showered once in 2 weeks. I was going days without food, my water was being rationed, I had to wash my hands in a bowl of water that was so dirty it was as brown as earth. My only shower had been a 30-second washdown with a single gallon of water from the stream. I was sleeping in a tent. I spent my days cabled between two trees. None of this was what you'd consider a healthy lifestyle. There were lots of reasons why it was silly to worry about the unhealthy effects of drinking a glass of wine, but of all those things that were happening to me, I couldn't control a single one. But I thought that I could control the things I ate and drank. It turned out that I was wrong. I sat there defiant. He stared back at me. As long as it takes. The fierce look on his face seemed to say. Minutes went by, the two of us staring at each other. 5 minutes. 10. Throughout this time, one thought kept rolling around in my mind. Whatever it takes to survive. I wanted to live. I wanted to get back to my family. I wanted to be rescued. And one day, I might be. But he wasn't going to let me eat or drink or sleep until I'd drunk the wine. And so, I drank it. And to this day, the smell of wine will almost instantly make me sick. I sipped the cup and tried to pass it on, but Mitchell would have none of that. I had to drink the whole thing, and so I forced it down. I thought it tasted terrible. I gagged a bit, but finished the cup. He filled it up again. This too, he commanded. I forced it down as well. He filled it up once again. I was forced to drink it down. He knew that was enough, so he finally let me eat. I dove in. I was so hungry. But the fog inside my mind was growing thicker. I was getting slower. A few minutes later, a little mouse snuck around the corner of the tent, casting a flickering shadow in the dim light. All of us turned to watch him. Mitchell picked up a piece of the cheese and threw it to him. The little mouse cautiously approached it, sniffed, then picked it up and scampered back into the shadows. I felt angry. This was our food. I didn't want to waste it. I didn't want to go hungry ever again. After eating, I felt exhausted. My belly was full of food and my blood was full of wine. I was so tired. I moved slowly toward the tent. The moment I lay down, I was asleep. Soon after, Mitchell came in to rape me. I woke up and tried to fight him, but I was barely even conscious. I wanted desperately to stay within myself, to stay in my right mind. But it was too late, and he did what he did. After, I lay on the mattress, feeling as low as I had ever felt. I felt terrible about the wine. I felt terrible about the rape. And as I lay there, I began to understand why some people might start to drink. Chapter 19. Routine. Although the days began to run together, I never lost count of them. The fourth day, the fifth,
a week, the second week, I was aware of every minute, every hour, every sunrise and sunset. In some ways, it never really hit me that time was starting to pass by. Emotionally, I was in it for the long haul. 30 years until he dies, was what I kept thinking at the time. Every day was long and painful. I was bored, I was scared, I was humiliated, homesick, and lonely. All night long, Mitchell was in and out of the tent, constantly interrupting my sleep as he got up to exercise in the dark. He thought that exercise could heal pretty much anything, so he would get up and go outside and bounce up and down on one foot and then the other, then do a lot of deep breathing. He was always anxious, never able to relax, even in the middle of the night. Barzi didn't seem to notice that he was always up and down. At least, she never complained. I'm pretty sure she always slept through the night. After a while, I started sleeping through his nightly exercising, too. Every day was much the same. We would get up with the sun. After climbing out of the tent, the first thing we did was have a morning devotional. We'd start out with a hymn from Barzi's collection of religious songs. There was no Onward Christian Soldiers or Welcome to Sunday School type of hymns in her collection. No, her songbook contained only hymns that were pointedly focused on God. We'd sing, then read from the scriptures or Mitchell's book, which was considered scripture too. Then we'd pray. Oh, how we'd pray. Brian David Mitchell had more to say to heaven than any other man in the world. 45 minutes was the norm. Kneeling, eyes closed, head down, my legs would cramp and my knees would hurt, and I'd be bored beyond my own tears. Maybe then he'd rate me, or maybe he'd wait until the afternoon, or maybe that night, or maybe one and then the other. Sheer Jashub, you are so lucky, he would remind me after the abuse. I brought you out of sin, I brought you out of the ugly world. Having just lived through another rape, I found it very hard to feel grateful. Over time, I learned about what they called the 7 Diamonds + 1. The 7 Diamonds were 7 books. The Bible, the Book of Isaiah by Avraham Gileadi, the Book of Mormon, The Final Quest by Rick Joyner, Embraced by the Light by Betty J. Eady, The Doctrine and Covenants, and The Golden 7+1 by C. Samuel West, which is all about natural healing and health. Those were the 7 Diamonds. The plus one was the Book of Emmanuel David Isaiah. I don't know if you'd really call it a book. It was only about 40 pages of Barzi's handwritten calligraphy bound between cardstock and stapled together. There was also a binder of Mitchell's personal papers, a collection of his blessings and revelations, his calling as a prophet and that kind of thing. These writings also contained the commandment that he was to take 7 wives. He didn't specifically mention that they had to be young girls, but Mitchell made it clear that this was his intention. That was the only way they would be malleable enough for him to control them, he would later admit. Finally, Barzi had written a long journal that chronicled their travels and conversion. On those rare occasions when her husband wasn't talking, she would read out of this journal to me. We always got up with the sun and went to bed when it grew dark. The weather was hot and monotonous. We were on the south face of the mountain and the sun bore down, cutting through the shade, making the afternoons very hot. All day long we'd sit around in our linen robes, which certainly didn't resemble linen any longer. At night when the sun went down, it quickly grew cold. We were high up on the mountain and the air was too thin to hold in the heat. To stay warm, we put on these gray men's shirts. They didn't have any buttons. You'd have to pull them over your head, and they were large and ugly, but I was grateful for something to keep the chill away. We never built fires in the beginning. We didn't necessarily need one to stay warm, but a hot meal would have been nice every once in a while. We would eat granola and nuts for breakfast, a few vegetables and fruit for lunch and supper. The fresh food never lasted long, however, and soon we were spreading mayonnaise on tortillas again and eating those with crackers and not much else. We didn't eat well, that was for sure. It seemed I was always uncomfortable, always thirsty, always in pain. Mitchell seemed to be completely confident that he was never going to get caught. But he was still careful, so he rarely hiked down to the spring to get us water, not wanting to take the risk of being seen or meeting someone on the trail. Plus, he was lazy.
It was hard work to hike down to the spring, and very hard work to bring a heavy container of water back up, as I would soon learn when they began to treat me like a mule. Eventually, Barzi began to figure out exactly what a handmaiden was. If her husband was going to use me for his pleasure, then she was going to use me too. And putting me to work was a good way to get even for all the attention that Mitchell seemed intent on showing me. She didn't let me prepare any of the meals. That was always just for her. But she made me do pretty much everything else. And it's amazing how much work there is to do when you are actually living in a camp. Once in a while, Mitchell would put me to work expanding the dugout. It was back-breaking work to shovel the dirt, but my cable would only reach partway into the dugout, and pretty soon I had dug about as far as I could go. When I wasn't working, the only thing I could do was read. During the first weeks, I made my way through almost the entire Old Testament and some of the other scriptures, too. But I was bored. Oh, so bored. It was an impossible adjustment to make. I'd been an active teenager. I was used to being involved in school and music and sports. I had a group of friends. My family and I always did things together. Now I was being cabled between two trees. 20 feet was as far as I could roam. I had the choice of listening to Mitchell talk or reading a few books. But that's all that I could do. When Mitchell wasn't talking, Barzi would be chatting in my ear. Sometimes it felt like I was being tortured by their voices. Tortured with boredom. Tortured with fear. Cabled. Humiliated. Taken from my home and family. It was no fun at all. Mitchell never trusted me. He certainly never gave me an opportunity to escape. He and Barzi never left me alone a single moment. I slept within a few inches of them. We spent every waking hour within a few feet of one another. I was forced to use a bathroom without even the slightest hint of privacy. Mitchell never took me off the cable. I was nothing but a caged animal. My faith was tested every day, and though I never really lost hope, as time went by, I certainly began to recalibrate my expectations. I realized he was never going to let me go. I realized he was going to keep me cabled until he knew that he could trust me. Over time, I quit thinking or hoping that anyone would find me. Instead, I started thinking about the things I had to do in order to survive. I never quit thinking about my family, but I gradually began to accept that he would kill them if I ever left him or if I ever tried to escape. The only people I ever talked to were him and Barzi. Every day, it was the same thing. More threats, more fear, more abuse and pain. All this proved to me that Mitchell was a very dangerous man. Did I believe that he would kill me if he had to? Absolutely. I did. Did I believe that he would hunt me down and kill my family? There was no doubt in my mind. Did I think that he was capable of murder? It's hard to be tortured and raped every day and believe that the man who is hurting you is not capable of anything worse. Did I think that he had friends who were willing to help him? It sure appeared he did. In fact, it seemed that he got everything he wanted. It seemed that he could lie or manipulate his way out of any situation. So yes, after a while, I started to believe some of the things he told me. Over time, I slipped deeper and deeper into pure survival mode until I came to measure every situation by only one thing. Was it going to help me to survive? That was the only thing that mattered, whatever it took to live another day. For the first week or 10 days, I cried and cried. I couldn't help it. The tears just flowed. It wasn't an all-day and all-night kind of thing. Mitchell would have never put up with that. But when I was not busy helping with meals or cleaning or doing the dishes or whatever else Barzi wanted me to do, I would sit on my bucket and the tears would soon come. I tried to keep myself together, and sometimes I could, but many times I simply couldn't help it. I cried for myself and the life that I had lost. I cried about the lost opportunities to be saved. I cried for my family. I cried for it all. Finally, Mitchell had had enough. "Stop it," he commanded. "You can't cry anymore." I looked at him, wiping my eyes in fear.
And quit talking about your parents. I don't want to hear it anymore. Your parents or your family. I'm sick of it all. Yeah, yeah, I get it. We both get it. He glanced angrily at Barzi. You loved your parents, you loved your family, but this is your new life. You need to look forward and not back, so I mean it. I don't want to hear your constant sniffling anymore.
I wiped my tears away, but inside I was crying even more. He was so heartless, so cold and unfeeling. I turned around to hide my tears, and as I did, I remember thinking of my grandfather. He is with me right now. I don't know where it came from. The thought was crystal clear. He is watching over me and protecting me. That is why Mitchell hasn't killed me. Grandpa is keeping me safe. Once again, I felt a flicker of hope. If my grandpa was protecting me, there had to be a reason. He wouldn't have helped me come this far just to let me die after suffering through so much. Soon after this, Mitchell told me he wanted to give me a blessing. He placed his hands on my head, called me by my real name, and said a prayer. He told me about my family. He said that they were going to be okay. He mentioned my grandfather. He told me my dad was a good man, but that my family had been misled. All of this was intended to manipulate me and draw me in. All of it was intended to convince me that he was my friend. It was designed to tie me to him, to make me dependent on him for my hope and my morale. It was designed to make me believe that he understood me, that he cared about me, and that he wanted to make me happy, that he wanted to trust me, but that I had to earn his trust. It was designed to make it harder and harder for me to remember my old life, to worry about my family, to care about him more. None of that worked. There was no Stockholm syndrome going on with me. I never formed attachments to my captors or bonded with them in any way. And though I was young, I wasn't stupid. I knew the only reason Mitchell tried to comfort me through this blessing was that he wanted to shut me